Welcome to Reboot Republic, a podcast that goes behind the headlines and looks at the big issues in this republic of inequality. We are the podcast of solutions and the podcast of hope, and I'm your host, Rory Hearn, and I'm delighted to be joined back on the pod by our very first guest on Reboot Republic hundreds and hundreds of episodes ago, and recent guest again, Mick Byrne, Dr. Mick Byrne from UCD. Mick, thanks so much for joining us again on Reboot.
Thanks for having me, Rory. Delighted to be here again.
Yeah, so today we're going to cover housing again. It's another housing shock episode. Mick has been leading the way in terms of analysis of investor funds, private rental, the housing crisis. And so we're going to have a bit of a chat about that. But first, just a reminder to our listeners that thank you to those of you who are patrons and supporters, and those who are not yet. Please, could you consider signing up to Reboot Republic? Become a supporter. You go over to patreon.com/tortoiseshack. We are the podcast that puts out the big issues on inequality, on housing issues, bringing you the voices from the frontline, change makers, experts. We know you value the podcast. We know you're listening. And of course, we've had some great ones recently. We had Una Mullally on discussing the housing crisis there, which is well worth listening back to. We've had Killian Woods, of course, from the Business Post. And Leisha Nealon from The Inquirer, just to name a few. Well worth listening back. You can go back and check our back catalogue. But yeah, please do help us to keep putting these out at costs. So go over to patreon.com/tortoiseshack. Thank you very much. So Mick, in terms of the, I suppose the most significant thing that happened aside from me going on Blind Boy in the last couple of weeks was the ESRI released a report, which I think is just, it is, my head's melted. Maybe it's the week before last, or is it last week? Was it last week?
I think it was last week.
Last week, right. And oh yeah, that's right. Yeah, when I got attacked by Richard Bruton. And it is essentially making the case, it's you know, a relatively short paper, but it's very well written, making the case that the government has the ability to borrow between 4 to 7 billion to invest in building social housing, public housing, affordable housing. And I was struck by the most significant aspect of the report for me was this idea of this would not be what we might call fiscally reckless, or it was actually financially prudent, and that it was economically doable. What's kind of your sense of your analysis of the report and its significance?
Yeah, I'd very much agree with that. I think what was so interesting about the report is, in a sense, it's kind of a it shows a kind of a coming together of two important shifts in politics, one in Ireland, one international. It kind of brings those two together. Internationally, of course, we're seeing this really quite significant shift away from the traditional neoliberal austerity era type fiscal policies, with the focus on cutback, especially in relation to capital spending, because as you'll remember from Ireland's austerity years, it was the capital spending budget that took the biggest hit, in particular the Department of Housing's capital spending budget.
Just explain, Mick, briefly, because capital is thrown around all the time. And of course, people might think of Marxist capital. But of course, that's not what you're talking about. Well, in a way it is. But maybe explain in the context of public spending, what are we talking about capital spending?
Well, you have two main types of government spending. On the one hand, you have the current spending, which is basically your ongoing monthly expenditure, right? So stuff that you pay every X period of time, and it's a regular aspect of government spending, like public sector wages, for example, or social welfare, or pension payouts. That kind of stuff is your current spending. Capital spending is not really about your day-to-day spending, but it's mainly about investing in the future, right? And so it's typically infrastructure investment, for example, roads, new hospitals, changes to your sewage infrastructure, all that type of stuff And housing investment falls within that. So, for example, social housing. Social housing is funded primarily in Ireland through the Department of Housing's capital spending budget. And that was cut back by 90% between around 2011 and 2014. And the reason it gets hit so hard in times of austerity is because it's much easier to cut back on something that isn't there yet, right? So when you cut back on capital spending, you're cutting back on investment in the future. Whereas when you cut back on current spending, that means you're cutting people's wages, you're cutting their pensions, you're cutting their job seekers allowance, so they feel it straight away. So politically, it tends to be a lot easier to cut back on capital than on current. But the consequences are disastrous, as we know in Ireland, because when you don't invest in the future, you end up with things like our chronic undersupply of housing. But what's been going on internationally, especially we see this with the Biden regime in the US, but also with the European Central Bank here in Europe and elsewhere, is there's been a real move away from let's cut everything back and reduce government debt as much as possible to a climate that's much more favorable in terms of investing in the future and more expansionary fiscal politics. In other words, government spending, government intervening in the economy, social services, etc. And that, in many ways, it really changes the whole nature of politics, because when there was more or less a consensus among parties at the center and the major political institutions that government debt had to be reduced at all costs, well, that really kind of constrained what was possible from a policy point of view in all sorts of important ways. And from the point of view of housing, it meant it was really hard to kind of make the case for a radical change, because of course you can't make a radical change without investing in the future, which does involve that capital spending, as I mentioned. So that change of context has been going on internationally, and I think it's going to be, well, it'll completely change the nature of politics over the next period, let's say 10 years or so. And what the ESRI paper does is it kind of links that context of saying, well, nowadays governments can borrow very, very cheaply. There's a much greater capacity to borrow in order to invest. And it links that context with what's happening in Ireland in terms of housing and the need to invest in housing.
Yeah, it's interesting. At a international level, are we seeing, like, is this a reemergence of Keynesian type, you know, policies and politics? Are we seeing a paradigm shift internationally? Like, is it, or is this something that could be rolled back in a couple of years? What's your sense of it? Because that is important in terms of government here making a shift, that if this is something that's really, you know, a paradigm shift at an international level, then making a paradigm shift at a local level and a radical change is less risky in that sense.
I think you could, at this stage, call it a paradigm shift, especially, I say, with the Biden administration being so, spending so much money on infrastructure and other forms of economic stimulus coming out of the pandemic. But yeah, I think it is a paradigm shift. I don't know if you'd call it Keynesianism, but certainly the experience of going through the last crisis and the failure of austerity has led to a number of things. Economists in general, I think, have moved away from the idea that government debt is the only or the principal economic problem that we need to tackle. So there's a much more, a wider understanding, I think, among economists, including mainstream economists, that you need that government spending and government debt can be sustainable under certain circumstances, and that government stimulus in terms of supporting economic growth or economic demand or investing in the future, things like climate adaptation and so on, can also play an important role. And that wasn't there before. And you even see that in institutions like the IMF, which were traditionally, of course, the real fiscal hawks, so to speak. And they published a paper about 2 weeks ago, a report on affordable housing in Europe. And the main recommendation from that report is that we need to increase investment in social housing across Europe. And that's something, of course, we really would not have expected to see 10 years ago. And you add to that then what's happening in the European Central Bank, where they've, you know, opened the taps and are injecting a lot of money into the European economy and so forth. So I think it is a big shift, and it creates a context in which we will see, I think, a return to much more ambitious ideas about the future of society in different ways. You know, I think we'll see it in climate. I think we'll see it in, and I think we'll see it in housing, which we're most interested in.
But Mick, you and I have been, you know, researching and campaigning against what you might call that broad, you know, neoliberal shift that's been going on since mid 1970s. It started, like, you're talking about 30 years, and our whole adult life has been defined, well, our lives have been defined by that ideology, that approach to economics, which was about, you know, the reduction in the role of the state. It no longer would, you know, provide council housing, no longer, you know, provide support industry, no longer, you know, invest in health. Like that whole change in both economic policy and ideology, that neoliberal phase, the whole privatizing of public services, you know, the degrading of you know, workers' conditions, that has been the dominant way of economic thinking for 30 plus years. Are we saying now that that's really neoliberalism is dead?
When you get into academic debates about neoliberalism, you know, they you could spend the rest of your life thinking about it. But I think, look,
at a political level,
with neoliberalism, though, right, we have to, there's a couple of different aspects of it that are most relevant for housing stuff here in Ireland, let's say. I mean,
yeah.
One idea is debt is bad, government debt is bad, and we need to reduce government debt, right?
Mm.
That idea is, I don't want to say it's dead, but there's not a consensus there that there was before, right? So
yeah,
government debt is increasing, obviously, with the pandemic across the world, and we're not really seeing inflation as the economic theories would have predicted, and we didn't see that a reduction in government debt was very positive for the economy in places like Greece and Spain, etc., in the austerity years, right? So that idea, there isn't the consensus there around it anymore. But the other side of neoliberalism is the idea that the market is better. In other words, it's more efficient at producing and allocating goods and services, right?
Yeah, so,
which is a slightly different idea than, right? And that idea, particularly in Ireland, I think, is under real threat. And that's really interesting in the ESRI paper, because almost in a throwaway remark, Kieran McQuinn, the author of the paper, says, well, the private sector isn't going to deliver the supply we need. And, you know, he doesn't even need to back that statement up, because there's an increasing recognition across Ireland, I think, even a consensus, that the private sector is not going to deliver anything close to adequate supply of housing. So if debt isn't bad from an economic theory point of view, and if the market isn't necessarily the most efficient or isn't an adequate way of delivering, in the case of housing, the number of housing units we need, that to me does add up to some major dents in the neoliberal orthodoxy. Now, whether there is something that's replacing it or what's going to happen in the future, you know, is maybe a bigger question. And I'm not sure what your take on it would be.
Well, I think that it is clear. I think COVID had quite a big impact as well in terms of that macroeconomic shift, because the response of states to COVID, clearly, I think you're right in terms of that there has been a learning from the failure of the austerity approach. And you're absolutely right when you point to countries like Greece, Spain, even Ireland, the idea that, obviously they point differently to Ireland, but particularly with, say, Greece, the idea that cutting back on your government debt would improve the situation, absolutely not. I think the response of states in terms of needing to you know, engage in an unprecedented level of public expenditure during COVID, I think that helped change something that was kind of changing anyway, because clearly, you know, with the rise of inequality, I think, like, that's the other side of this, like, inequality, particularly in the States, has been, you know, is at unprecedented levels. And I think that there has been a public backlash against neoliberalism that's been going on for decades as well, with all through the period, this assertion that actually this is not a good way to do things, inequality is rising. So I think it's as much a recognition that people have said, the public has said, we're not taking this anymore in terms of the levels of inequality, as much as this kind of economic understanding that that didn't quite work from a statistical perspective. That I think there's a combination of, you're right, it's a political, it's a public, and an economic combination, confluence with COVID, that means ideas that were taboo 5 years ago are suddenly now discussable because COVID threw everything out the window. That, you know, we had to, you know, tear up the rule book and go, yeah, if we're actually going to keep things going.
I think you're absolutely right. And I think it's kind of those three things. There was the bad experience of trying to solve the financial crisis, which undermined the validity of a lot of neoliberal economic theories, right? There was that experience. Then that was followed by major political disruption in the form, particularly of right-wing populism. And that signaled, I think, to opinion makers, policy makers, power brokers, that neoliberal capitalism was not offering people any sense of having control over their future, being able to create a better life, etc. Right. Yeah. And so there was that whole crisis associated with populism. And then we had the COVID thing, which changed everything we kind of thought was possible economically. Mm-hmm. So we've had those kind of three blows and taken together. Yeah, I do think it's a very changed context, which, you know, doesn't mean the context is, you know, it doesn't mean there's going to be any easy solutions or whatever, but it does change the nature of the politics of the questions we're asking.
No, absolutely. And it also, it changes the political potential of what we can look for and what we can debate around. Like, I think you're absolutely right to point out that, you know, I think what the SRI said about, you know, that the private sector is not going to do this. Like, that in itself is a profound statement from our leading advisories, you know, research agency in the country, that they say. And I think that's also what has happened. The private sector has demonstrated it won't provide affordable housing. It can't. It's just not in its nature. And the other side of that, of course, is that as part of the neoliberal, you know, rise over the last 30 years has been this rise of financialization, the emergence of financial corporations, be it in, you know, in the markets, commodifying everything. And I think there's a reaction against that. And we've seen that at a really extreme level here in Ireland, which you and I have researched and highlighted, which is, of course, the emergence of the real estate landlord, the vulture funds, the way in which they have also entered our housing systems and have made it even more accentuated, even more the affordability crisis. And in that context, then people are turning to the state and saying, we need protection here. You're supposed to be protecting us. But then when they find out that actually the state has been facilitating those vulture funds, it all starts to go to pot for the government. And just in terms of, I suppose, to go on maybe a little bit about, move on, because as you say, we're going to have to wait and see what the implications of the SRI report are. Do you see the government shifting? I said they should put in place an emergency budget as a result of it to dramatically increase the spending. There's no reason why they couldn't turn around tomorrow and say, we're actually going to double the capital spending in the housing budget as an emergency budget.
I think we have yet to see really what Dara O'Brien is going to do in housing. I think people forget that a little bit. His strategy around housing, which I think they're calling Homes for All or Housing for All.
Yes, the new plan is developing.
It's going to be published, supposed to be published next month in July. Mm. And I think it's going to be really interesting to see what's in that. Because what we've seen in previous years, we've seen this with Simon Coveney and we've seen more of it with Owen Murphy, is what I have called the too little too late housing policies, right? So they've done a lot of the right things, but they haven't done it enough and they've done it too late. They increased investment in social housing, but they've waited until 2016 when we were way too far into the crisis to do it. They've regulated the private rental sector better with the RPZ rent caps, with some more protections for tenants in terms of security of tenure, but they've left it too late and they haven't made the protection strong enough. So it was always this kind of, yes, we're going to do something, but no, it's not going to be kind of decisive enough to make a difference. So I think what's going to be really interesting is, does Dara O'Brien kind of go along with that same type of approach? Like, oh, yes, I want to be seen to be doing something and have some flagship policies in there, but I'm not going for something big and something decisive here. So I think that will tell us a lot. And what will it may come down to really is, you know, how much the thinking has shifted in terms of Fine Gael, in terms of the Department of Public Expenditure and the Department of Finance, and where they, to what extent they are going to be willing to fund major change, or are they going to want to go more cautiously? And I know, you know, even at the very beginning of the crisis, I attended a seminar where Pascal O'Donoghue spoke, and, you know, he made the point that we still are in a situation in Ireland in which the financial markets could turn on us again, as they did in 2010, 2011, 2012. And that fear is still there. And to what extent will that continue to shape the thinking in terms of how much? So I do think we will definitely see a significant increase in capital spending for social housing. I do think we will see that. Will it go to the 4 billion? I would guess not, but I do think it will be significant increase.
It's interesting. It's something that I think that the other issue is alongside that needs to be brought in is the increase in spending, capital spending on social housing, but also on the cost rental housing and affordable housing. I think the significant capital investment and facilitation of, you know, supports for AHBs and local authorities to actually build, like, you know, his current plan is saying 4,000 affordable units over 4 years, but like, why not 4,000 units per year? Like, that's the level of scale where we need to be going to actually really address the crisis, isn't it?
Oh, there's no doubt about it. And the ESRI paper, you know, they talk about trying to hit 18,000 social housing units per annum. Which again, it's only in 2016 when talking about 10,000 social housing units per annum was quite radical. And you know, now the ESRI is saying we should be producing 18,000. So, yeah, absolutely, that's the scale. There's no question, because we are heading into, in my view, when the consequence of the decline in output in terms of housing in general in 2020 and 2021 is going to be, in my view, catastrophic.
Do you say that?
Because our housing system under Rebuilding Ireland was predicated on the idea that we would now be coming close to achieving the roughly 30,000 units a year that we need in terms of housing altogether. And what has happened, in fact, is the opposite. Because we were hitting around the 21,000, 22,000 coming into COVID, but it's as low as somewhere between 15,000 and 20,000 units last year in 2021, and it's going to be the same this year. And that is just that, you know, people will feel that there will be just less houses will be coming on the market, and then therefore there'll be less also houses available to rent, et cetera, and people are going to be, the queues are going to be longer, and we'll see that pushing up prices then, and rents tend to track house prices. So if house prices go up, I think rents will as well. On top of that, a lot of households have increased their savings very significantly during COVID-19. And we've seen that from previous ESRI research. There's been an unprecedented amount of saving among those households who haven't been affected economically. And what that you know, they're going to then be in a position to bid higher for houses. So I think when those savings hit a very supply-constrained housing market, we're looking at trouble.
Combined with the continued influx of investors and investment funds.
A very, very important point. Yeah, very well put.
Yeah, that is going to, absolutely. Yeah. And combined with that then is that kind of gulf divide within COVID between those households, as you said, who've saved, and then those households who actually, you know, suffered income loss, most of whom are in the private rental sector, who are going into arrears, who are going into, who are in very difficult situations. And of course, they're, it's often, we're not really capturing or getting any sense of that impact, are we? That, and that's something I know you wanted to talk about, that in terms of the recent, you know, measures that Dara O'Brien has introduced, that they're, you know, targeted purely at those, they're targeted at those who are affected by, their income is affected by COVID. This is for private renters, but it's only for those who come forward and apply for it. And it's only for those who can show they're in arrears as a result of COVID. It doesn't provide this blanket protection, which is surely needed for private rental tenants at this point.
Yeah, I think this is really a really interesting discussion, because it's, I think if you understand the problems with this policy, you can learn a lot about how to make policy better in the rental sector in general. As you say, like 44% of households in the worst impacted economic sectors during COVID are private renting households.
Mm.
On top of that, we know that there's, at the moment, I think it's 250,000 people on the PUP, but only 500 households have come forward to take advantage of the protections from Dara O'Brien in terms of if your income has been impacted by COVID, you declare yourself to the RTB and your landlord that you have been impacted, and on that basis, you're protected from eviction or from a rent freeze. Now, the problem is exactly as you say, tenants feel very, very vulnerable, right? The relationship between a landlord and a tenant, this is something that's crucial to understand. It's a power relation, right? Mm-hmm. The landlord controls the tenant's continuing access to their home. One of the most important things, if not the most important thing in anyone's life. So that sets up a power relation. Tenants, number one, this piece of legislation is extremely confusing and the outcomes of it are a little bit uncertain. So if you're a tenant and you apply for this, for example, your landlord can then say, well, my income has been impacted, in which case you don't get any protection then, right? So the landlord can kind of counter-apply. So it's one of these things where the outcomes are uncertain. And because tenants feel vulnerable, they're unlikely to do something that's not going to necessarily make things better for them, right? And I know this from previous research I've done. On top of that, tenants really don't want to indicate to their landlord that they can't afford to pay the rent, right? Tenants feel that they don't even want to contact their landlord. I've just completed a piece of research looking at tenants' experiences in the private rental sector. And the number of tenants who said to me, yeah, as one tenant put it, for example, they said, I wouldn't contact my landlord if the house was on fire.
Yeah.
And, you know, this is not to say all experiences are like this, and I'm not saying all landlords are bad landlords, et cetera, but the reality is many, many tenants will tell you that they are afraid to contact their landlord. And what you hear time and again is, I don't want to hassle them. I don't want to rock the boat. I want to fly below the radar. I heard those phrases so many times in the research. In addition, so tenants don't want to basically have any engagement with their landlord if they can avoid it. On top of that, they definitely don't want to signal to the landlord that they maybe can't pay their rent and that they're in trouble, because they feel that could lead to the loss of their home. And so when you create policies for the private rental sector, and we've seen this time and again with different policies, which don't acknowledge that vulnerable position that tenants are in, which don't acknowledge that tenants are in a power relationship with their landlord, what ends up happening is the policies don't have the outcome we want in practice, because they don't get taken up by tenants, or in some cases, because you end up with non-compliance from landlords. Landlords don't always follow the rule.
It's a really important point. So what would you do? What would you, in terms of how do you change that power dynamic? What do you do?
Well, I think, if we're... Just to briefly mention kind of COVID-specific stuff first, one of the things that was really noticeable from the research I'd just done was that this particular scheme, the one we're talking about at the moment, only 10% of tenants I spoke to had actually heard of the scheme, knew it existed, right? Which didn't surprise me at all.
Yeah.
Whereas the ban on evictions more than 80% of the tenants had heard it.
Wow.
So I think that speaks to is that what tenants are going to be interested in and understand is simple, blanket, and universal policy measures. So something you can immediately understand. It's not, you know, if X qualified happens, then Y. Exactly. It's not complex. You don't need to go to the RTB. You don't need to fill out paperwork. There's just a rule that's there, and you're clear on what it is and what it means.
So therefore you can feel confident with the landlord that it's very straightforward and you're not trying to ask the landlord to do something because...
Exactly. It's straightforward. You know the outcome. You know the consequence for you. It's not going to be a messy, stressful conflict with your landlord where you end up, you know, what a lot of tenants end up doing is exchanging angry WhatsApp messages with their landlords over this kind of stuff, you know, and all sorts of real, really, you know, quite unprofessional stuff happens in the private rental sector, unfortunately. More generally, then, I do think we need to really, for once and for all, deal with this problem in Ireland about the vulnerable nature of tenancies. And there's a couple of different pieces. I think there's three aspects to it. You know, the most straightforward one is the policy aspect. We need to give tenants complete security of tenure, complete. So the way I understand that is at the moment, tenancies in the private rental sector are 6-year tenancies. But in practice, as you know, the landlords can end the tenancy. So in reality, tenancies last as long as a landlord wants them to last, right?
Yeah.
But what it should be, in my view, is you move in for 6 years and there is no way to get you out during those 6 years unless you don't pay the rent or, you know, something along those lines. But if you play ball, you will 100% be sure where you're going to be living for the next 6 years if you want to live there for 6 years, right? So that's the first thing. So just get that.
And could,
that
why shouldn't that be 12 years or 20 years?
In my view, it would be necessary to assess the impact of that measure on the supply of housing first. So I think it would be unwise to introduce protections that were taking things, not taking things too far, but that would potentially destabilize an already quite chaotic market. And I think 6 years is a reasonable period of time. Like if you move in, let's say you have a 2-year-old child.
Well, I was thinking 12 years or even 18 years is the time you need for the stability of a child.
It is. And it would be much better. I mean, it should be lifetime security should be the goal, but at least with 6 years, you can plan 6 years ahead. And that's a hell of a lot better
than what exists at the moment.
Exactly. So that's one thing. And with that, I mean, what should come with that is, you can change the dwelling, you can have pets, you can smoke, you can paint the walls, you can hang things on the walls. It's your house for the duration of the tenancy.
Your home.
Your home, exactly. And that, you know, that's something that I know you've spoken about an awful lot in the past, how important that is.
Yeah, no, I think that's so important. Mick, I could talk to you all day and we'll definitely have you back again soon. One last one just on the sense that Generation Rent, Generation Stuck at Home are, you know, starting to stand up, are speaking out or expressing themselves in lots of different ways. Obviously, I was on Blind Boys podcast there last week, which was very interesting. And I think, you know, the reaction to that has been incredible. Again, similar to some of the media have done recently, you know, so many people contacting me saying, you know, some saying they want to change it, they want to take action. Others saying, I'm just going to emigrate. Others saying, you know, the horrendous impact of this. Where do you feel we're at in terms of what you might call the culture, the politics, people, Generation Rent? Are we going to see a movement change?
I think that the podcast you did with Blind Boy was really interesting. And I thought, you know, you were talking a lot of, when you talked about home and the importance of home, you were talking a lot about the impact on families. Mm. And children and that type of stuff, which I know is particularly important to you. And, you know, you've done that research on emergency accommodation in the past. And Blind Boy was talking about more so the impact on single young people, and that was really, really interesting too. And I think that kind of speaks to the fact that we're seeing now, as we have more and more long-term renters and more family renters and more children who are growing up in the rental sector, as well as the maybe more traditional single younger person, there's going to be a growing kind of coming together, I suppose, of different social groupings. I do think, though, there's kind of two ways this could go. One hypothesis, and I've heard Jack Horgan-Jones, political correspondent with the Irish Times, he has made the argument that housing is going to be the new healthcare, that it'll be a perennial problem. No matter how much you increase the budget, it never gets fixed. You know, it's always a pain for governments. It's always a number one or number two issue come election time. But at the same time, there's a normalization of crisis and the electorate ends up kind of coming to the belief that ultimately, you know, it's important, but we know no matter who we vote for, nothing's going to change with it. And it just becomes one of those, it just becomes the politics of it become like that of the healthcare sector at the moment. I think that's a very, very plausible analysis, because I do think it is going to be extraordinarily difficult for any government to do anything in the housing system that will have an impact, right? I genuinely believe that. So I think that's one way of thinking about it. And then the other way of thinking about it is more so actually what we're going to see now is that renting combined with a couple of other issues will lead to a generational shift that will start to change electoral politics and also maybe protest politics as well. And that argument, you know, which I've seen quite a few people put forward in the Irish context, and you know, what often gets mentioned there is, you know, increased support for Sinn Féin and other left-wing parties, for example. And I think there is, you know, I'm not a political scientist, but there is a lot of evidence from Europe around this generational change in politics and how it's impacting electoral politics. But as we know, there's an awful lot more old voters than young voters. And therefore, can Generation Rent come election time, given how fragmented the left is and given how many voters there are who are over 50, can they have a decisive impact that, you know, some people, including yourself, I think, might want them to have?
That's interesting. It's very interesting. I think that's well worth discussing and thinking about further. My sense is that I think that you know, what you said out there around the health, you know, becoming normalized, accepting, there's no doubt that's a very clear possibility. I think we're not there yet. We're absolutely not there yet. And I think that there's still a possibility in the next coming years to reshape. And it's interesting what you say that, you know, the older voters, I think that there's a big shift, and this is, it does tap into the marriage equality and repeal campaigns, that those cross-generational conversations, and that I think the biggest challenge we could put to changing this system is if we get the majority of people to agree that continuously rising house prices are not a good thing, and to actually accept that falling house prices are a positive thing. And I think that that is potentially shifting, particularly with Generation Rent been stuck at home, or generation stuck at home with their elderly parents, whatever, 60s, 70s, and going, we've no possibility of a home, buying a home, and people sitting there going, what's the point in the value of this house if my children can't get a home? And I feel that Ireland is a particular, given our size, given the way we still talk to each other, given the way we interact, I think there's still a real possibility for a value shift to take place that could kind of represent or force that whoever is in government, that they have to make a big change.
Yeah, I mean, do you know what I think is fascinating about, say, for example, what you were talking about in the Blind Buy podcast, and it's something I've heard you touch on in a couple of recent podcasts and stuff you've written. That link between the personal, emotional, and the policy/political, you know, when the telling, I think you talked about it, you know, telling the stories of the housing crisis. And that really is something that makes a lot of sense to me, because as somebody who does qualitative research, I spend a lot of my time talking to tenants, and there's so much more to this housing crisis than what gets discussed in the media, which is really just prices and supply, right? It's just those two numbers. How many units, what is the price? But there's the stories of that you hear go really much beyond that. And what's particularly interesting about that is what we've seen in the repeal and in the marriage equality referendums was very much the politicization of those personal stories. And those personal stories became hugely impactful and the relatability of the stories. And if we do end up with a referendum on the right to housing, I think it could be really interesting to, if that kind of brings together both that generational and value change you're talking about with that integration of the personal and the political to create something that I think you're absolutely right, could be very decisive.
Yeah. Well, that's great. I have to say, I'll take you up on that ending optimism. I'll take that as your final bid on it. I think that just, and because we have to finish up, unfortunately, to people that if they do want to share their story of how the housing crisis is affecting them, I have been gathering them along with Uplift to try and highlight them. So Uplift have a survey. If you go to uplift.ie, you can fill out a survey which documents your story, which we're putting together. And also you can send them to me directly on Twitter or email me at rory.hearn@mu, and I will post them when we're gathering them, because I think there is a huge power in that. And what I've again spoke about, the struck of the way people telling their stories publicly, even anonymously, is overcoming the shame and stigma that people feel. And so I think that's a really important aspect. But Mick, listen, in terms of you're doing now a weekly information newsletter analysis piece for on the housing issues. So people, how can they get that?
Yeah, it's the Week in Housing, a one-page summary of new research, evidence and policy in Irish housing every week. It's very short, very snappy, kind of tells you everything you need to know type of thing, with great some crack analysis as well in there too. It's enormously fun. I think crack is the first word that would come to anyone's mind when they think of a weekly update on housing policy. You need to get out more Rory, big time. Now, the easiest way to find it is if you go to my Twitter page, ask Mick Byrne 101. There's a link to it in the little blurb there. It's substack.com/theweekinhousing.
And will they enter a black hole then?
Yes, yeah, they'll never get their life back. Now, the whole beauty of this thing is it's short. So you just need to read one page and you will know any significant new evidence or policy in Irish housing that week. Brilliant. Very important to stay informed.
Absolutely. Well, we'll have to get you back on to summarize some of that if you'd be up for it.
Absolutely, I'd love to.
Yeah, great. Well, listen, Mick Byrne from UCD, it's been absolutely wonderful, as always, to have you on Reboot Republic. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
And a reminder to our listeners, if you are a supporter, thank you very much. If you're a patron supporter, if you're not, please consider it. Go over to Tortoise Shack. You can go over to Tortoise Shack and check out all the podcasts across the platform. But if you just want to go help us, go over to patreon.com/Tortoise Shack. And help us continue to put out these podcasts. They are bringing the voices of the likes of Mick here, who are offering some really important insights that need to be heard, the conversations, a little bit of crack along the way, and contributing to this value shift that's needed, the change that's needed. So, and as always, we love to hear your comments and views. As I said, you can get me at Reboot Republic on Twitter, at Rory Hearn, and please go over to patreon.com/tortoiseshack. Sign up, support us. We don't have any ads. And the more patron supporters that sign up, the less rambly nonsense like this that I will have to do. So please do that. And we look forward to talking to you all soon. Bye-bye.